We are continuing our series on the Ten Commandments. We're coming to the end now, guys, which means I'm at one of my least favorite parts of preaching, which is figuring out a new series. So we have two more in this, obviously, false witness, and the next week is coveting. And then we will probably do something New Testament. I haven't decided yet, but we'll figure it out. That is not correct. It is not 9 a.m. It is 10:30. It is an hour and a half off. I need to put this right there. Otherwise, I'm going to preach for an hour and a half. Okay. All right. So the ninth commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Exodus 20, verse 16. This command is interesting primarily because of how specific it is, right? This is not the generic term for lying. There is a bunch, now in English, obviously, the same way. In Hebrew, there's a bunch of different words for lying. There's the main one. This is not the main one, right? This is specifically bearing false witness. In Proverbs 6, 16 through 19, which is an interesting verse, and people sometimes ask, why do we read the Old Testament, right? Okay, if the Old Testament's gone away, the Old Covenant is done, well, what is the Old Testament for? Learning about God, that's what the Old Testament is for. Who is God? What is he like? The character of God is seen a lot in the Old Testament in verses like this. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Saying false things is on the list twice. The generic lying, one who is a lying tongue, and then the specific, a false witness who breathes out lies. And why is this the command instead of you shall not lie? That would be a good command too. A false witness really checks like six of the, or maybe six of these, up to six of these really. One who is a false witness might be arrogant, have haughty eyes. One who is a false witness might have a heart that devises wicked plans, right? If you're in thinking about how can I falsely accuse or present false witness in a testimony, well, that you might be doing that from a wicked plan in your heart. You might be one who is hastening to run to evil. Ooh, I get to put this guy in jail or whatever it is, right? I get to make this guy look bad. I'm going to run to do this wicked thing. And of course, one who is a false witness would definitely sow discord among brothers, right? So a false witness, if you think about, and this is not obviously the only things that the Lord hates, but in this particular passage, as Solomon is highlighting things that the Lord hates, a false witness hits a lot of these things. It is a component of a lot of these things, which is why I think we think about the commandment, you shall not bear false witness. You shall not speak falsely in a very specific way because of what it does. So there's the more generic lying and then the more specific false witness. Now, the importance of truth. We talked a lot about love. Oh, it was right before this series, I think. We talked a lot about love. Truth is another one of those big concepts in Scripture that is tied closely to who God is. Titus 1, 1 and 2. Paul, a servant of God, an apostle of Jesus Christ, for the sake of the faith of God's elect and their knowledge of the truth, which accords with godliness, in hope of eternal life, which God, who never lies, promised before the ages began. The idea of truth here, what? The knowledge of the truth. And truth which what? Truth which accords with godliness, coming from God who never lies, speaks. He always speaks the truth. Hebrews 6, 17 through 18. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of his promise, that would be Abraham in the Old Testament, and then, of course, the Israelites, and then us now. We're the heirs now, right? When God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath so that by two unchangeable things, what's the two unchangeable things? Himself and the oath, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope. And then it goes on and on and on. Truth, like love, is central to God's very being. It is fundamental to who he is. He is love and he cannot lie. He cannot speak falsehood. Now, there's a couple ways you can think about this. This is a little bit of a sidetrack, but it's an important point I want to make. If you have the ability to speak into existence reality, God said, let there be light, it would be impossible for you to lie in what sense? Anything that you say happens. So even if God were to say something that is, not that he would do this, but even if he were to say something different than what he's already said, that then would become reality. If your words dictate the very fabric of reality itself, then not only can you not lie because of your character as a person of truth, but you can't lie simply because what you say becomes reality. It becomes real just by the very nature of your power. Truth is a central characteristic of God. So, this concept of a false witness, as it's a more specific form of truth and falsehood, not this generic, we're going to look at the generic form too, the generic idea of lying, but the command is specific about false witnessing, which is found all over the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 19, 15 through 20, excuse me, a single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Why? Well, because of this, the need for this command. People lie. He knows that. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days, whoever that happens to be, right? The judges would obviously change. The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, you shall do to him as he meant to do to his brother. So whatever the consequence of the sin, or the way that it worked in this particular text, say the charge was murder. I don't know. Let's just pick murder, for example. So somebody brings a false charge of murder. He knows it's not true, but this person, and the idea of maliciousness is important in here, right? Because God knows it could be a mistake, right? It's not necessarily malicious if you really think that, let's talk about Keith. I like using Keith. Let's say I think that Keith murdered John, who's sitting next to him. Well, I could really think that. I might be mistaken in my belief. But I might really earnestly think that Keith did that, and I would accuse him of that, because, you know, murderers shouldn't get away with stuff. That would be different than, I knew who really killed John, I know it wasn't Keith, but I'm going to accuse Keith anyway, right? That's the maliciousness. And so what's in here, the consequence for that would be, whatever the consequence that I was seeking for Keith, because of this false witnessing, which in the Old Testament would have been death, right? That's what the consequence would have been. That would be done to me, because I would have been found to be testifying falsely against Keith. I would get whatever, and it would be different depending on the charge, right? If it was theft, I falsely accused Keith of theft, then I would have to pay him back whatever it was, right? I'm seeking recompense from Keith. I would be the one to have to pay Keith, because I falsely accused him of that. And then there's this text at the end there, right? So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit any such evil among you. We've looked at a lot of texts in the Bible in these last 9 weeks as we've looked through the Old Testament passages about these things. 7 of the 9 times in connection with these commands has been a very specific phrase. Purge the evil from among you. Bad behavior, wickedness, is contagious, isn't it? It's contagious. It spreads like disease throughout a group of people. One person does a bad thing and there's no consequences. And then the next person thinks, oh, that person got away with that thing. I could do that thing too. And before you know it, that behavior spread throughout the body. And there's never been any consequences before. So why not just keep doing this? And before you know it, everybody's committing such evil. And whatever it happens to be, it doesn't just have to be false witnessing. Consequences are necessary for sin in large part because of this, so that the rest will stand in fear and will not do this evil. And it's a difficult thing. If you've been at churches maybe that have been like this, churches that have been lax and just let people do whatever they want and not held people accountable, it's very difficult to start holding people accountable. It's a difficult transition. If you've been in a church for 20 years that nobody's been held accountable and now suddenly we're trying to hold people accountable, It's a very dangerous situation to be in spiritually. Now, Solomon had a lot to say about false witnessing. Proverbs 19:5, a false witness will not go unpunished. He who breathes out lies will not escape. 21:8, a false witness will perish. The word of a man who hears will endure. 24:28, be not a false witness against your neighbor without cause, and do not deceive with your lips. Again, that idea without cause, right? Let's go back to the analogy. I might be technically a false witness of Keith, against Keith, but if I earnestly believe that he murdered John, then I do have cause for that, right? It's not that I'm being malicious in this. I think that that's what happened, and I want my testimony to be heard. And we know there's a difference, obviously, between wrong testimony and lying testimony, obviously, because people are mistaken all the time. Right? So we keep reading in, I think I have one more, 25:18. A man who bears false witness against his neighbor is like a war club or a sword or a sharp arrow. Is what? It's damaging, it's killing, it's hurting. Exodus 23:1-3, you shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit, siding with the many, so as to pervert justice, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. And here's the point. What's at stake here? Why this command as opposed to the generic sin of lying, which we know lying's wrong, and God talks in a lot of places that we just read one in Proverbs, and even in the Old Testament, he said, don't lie. A lot of places about not lying. So why is it the specific thing in the Ten Commandments? What's at stake here above the general idea of lying that is worthy of being in this major list? It's the idea of justice. That this does not just have personal consequences. This has societal consequences. That it will not just affect you and your relationships, but it will affect the group as a whole. That justice will be perverted because of your false testimony. The wrong man or woman will be punished for the thing, whatever it happens to be. And the one who should be disciplined, the one who should have the consequence, will go free. You know how you feel about that, right? When somebody that you know did a wrong thing gets away with it, how it makes you feel? You know how that makes you feel. Maybe you're different than me. It makes me angry, personally. When I know that somebody's done a wrong thing, and especially if it's affected me, and they just get away with it, and there's no consequence for that. Where did that sense of anger come from? Probably from God. Isaiah 5:16, the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice. The holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. Jeremiah 5:28-29. They know no bounds in deeds of evil. They judge not with justice. They the cause of the fatherless to make it prosper. They do not defend the rights of the needy. Shall I not punish them for these things? Declares the Lord. Hosea 12:6. So you, by the help of your God, return. Hold fast to love and justice. And wait continually for your God. Micah 6:8. He has told you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with your God? And we could even see this carried into the New Testament, Luke 11:42. Woe to you Pharisees, as Jesus is condemning them. You tithe mint and rue and every herb, but neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Hebrews 11:32. What shall we say? What more shall we say? Time would fail to tell me of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith did what? Conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, and then he lists a bunch of other stuff that they did. Do you think justice matters to God? I don't know how you can read, and this is like a smattering of it, right? We could do dozens and dozens of passages that talk about the importance of justice to God. Again, built into the very nature of who he is. That's why this commandment, you shall not bear false witness, is so important. Because of what it does to not just the individual, but to the group as a whole. Why it's so important, and he even says this in the New Testament, right? You shall not accept a charge against an elder except on the evidence of what? Two or three witnesses. Because we have a penchant for lying, saying what we want in order to get some sort of... And it could be, why would you bear false witness? Maybe you want revenge against somebody who you think did something wrong to you. Maybe you don't like that person. Maybe you don't like what they've done and you want them to be punished, whatever it happens to be. There's a lot of reasons. But they all stem from selfishness, don't they? As opposed to what? Walking humbly with your God? Bearing false witness, lying in this way, is arrogance. It is selfishness. It is self-centeredness. That you care more about what you want than what is right. Speaking truth is one of the foundations of justice, both in our personal lives and as a society. And we think about this as a society as a whole. We obviously, I think, know the importance of bearing true testimony in court. But even in the church, as a group, this would, if you want to tear a church apart, start lying about people, about what they've done, and start saying that people have done wrong things that they haven't done. If you want to destroy the Dewey Church of Christ, that would be a good way to start. Now, hopefully our love and our love of truth and justice, we would be able to discern and figure out what's going on and overcome that through the power of God. But it destroys people and groups. This, like so many of the Ten Commandments, hasn't changed as we come into the New Testament. And we read a bunch of passages. Oh, that I keep looking at that clock, and that clock is incorrect. This, like so many of the Ten Commandments in the New Testament, has not changed. It's not different as we come from the old to the new, and we think about these ideas of God, these, and why I said this earlier, why we study the Old Testament. One of the reasons we do that is to know who God is, and God suddenly isn't different than he was. So in all these Old Testament passages where he talks about loving justice and the need for justice, that's not different now. 1 Timothy 1:8 through 11, we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully. Understand this, the law is not laid down for the just, those who are users or doers of just things, justice, but for the lawless, the disobedient, the ungodly, the sinners, the unholy, the profane, those who, and this is a list of things that bad people do, strike their fathers and mothers, murderers, sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality, enslavers, and then, again, like the list in Proverbs, speaking false things is listed twice. Liars and perjurers. One who speaks just generic lying, the lying of just personal lying, and also those who lie under oath. Listed twice, separately. And whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. In accordance with the gospel of the glory of the blessed God with which I have been entrusted. Separated out from perjury, and notice what they're grouped with, the things that they are grouped with. This is how God feels about falsehood, both in the generic sense of saying wrong things, or not wrong, wrong's not the right word, saying untrue things, things that you know to be false. Because we say wrong, and again, there's a difference, obviously, between being mistaken and being a liar, right? We're all of us are mistaken about things. Nobody knows everything, and you're not going to be, I don't think, punished because you had a wrong idea. Now you will be in the generic sense of salvation, why it's so important that we spread the gospel. But if I have a false idea about somebody that I earnestly believe and it's causing a strain, what's my obligation? I need to go make sure that what I know to be true is actually true, instead of just assuming, and even in areas of testimony like we're talking about here, the difference between liars and perjurers, one under oath and one not under oath. My responsibility as a child of God is to make sure that the things that I say are true. I have that responsibility, not to guess. Now, obviously, sometimes I'm going to be wrong, but if I have not made any effort to find the truth out, I'm just sort of guessing, or I think I know, or maybe I know, and I haven't made any effort to concretely come to an understanding, to gain some sort of evidence that would support one way or the other, and I just sort of say things out of the side of my mouth that I've made up or that are half true, that's on me. Because I did not take the time and the effort to find out what is true when I could very easily have done so. Not the truth, of course, is the only thing we must consider in our speech. And again, as we think about the Ten Commandments, a lot of them carry into the New Testament, there's always another extra layer. Isn't there a more perfect layer? And this is why we have the more perfect way now, right? This is the more perfect way. So what's the extra layer on this? With murdering, it was the idea of being angry without cause. With committing adultery, it was the idea of lust itself, right? Well, there is also with our speech. Ephesians 4, 25 through 29. Therefore, having put away falsehood, right? Don't lie. Each of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down in your anger. Give no opportunity to the devil. I've used this in the last like three lessons. Why? You know what's a great opportunity for the devil? When you know like half the truth. When you think you know and you're not quite sure and you don't take the time to investigate, and so you start spreading rumors and you start saying false things, even though you may think they're right, but you didn't really try to figure it out. That's a great opportunity for the devil to just slip on in and cause all sorts of division. Let the thief no longer steal. Let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. Put away falsehood. Speak the truth. Yes, obviously. But also consider in your speech, does it build up? Does it fit the occasion? Does it give grace? Because we can take this to the extreme, right? The idea of, oh, I'm just being honest. Well, if you were mean, how many passages did we read about loving kindness as well as justice in those Old Testament texts? About the idea of love in our speech as well. You can be honest without being mean. You can be honest without being a jerk. You can be honest without violating these ideas. Thinking about not just what we say, but how we say it, the context in which we say it, who we say it to. Because God expects more of us, because we have the completed word. The thing that he expects more of us in this particular area is not just that we will say true things, but we will say things that build up, things that fit the occasion, and things that give grace. Thinking about the things that we say on a deeper level. Ephesians 4:15, rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. Truth and love, more than anything else, I think these are the two characteristics, are the defining characteristics of Yahweh. And I say Yahweh there, his personal identity, right? The name that he gave to Moses to call him, I am. He is a being of truth and love. And thus, we are to speak truth in love to each other. Thinking about when I speak, yes, is this thing true? But also, does it fit the occasion that I'm speaking? Is this a good place to say this particular thing? Is this a good group of people to say that thing to? Is this group of people likely to misunderstand what I say, even if it is technically true? How should I phrase this in a way that is not just true, but in a way that is edifying? What words should I pick? Maybe it's, I don't say it now, but I'm going to say it later, because later would be a time that it would give more grace. Later would be a time that it would build up more. It would fit a better occasion. And the classic thing, right, you don't have to say everything you know. There are times when withholding is going to be the thing that builds up and gives grace and fits the occasion. There are times when obviously you need to speak out, especially of wrongdoing and bearing true witness. That's a thing that can fit the occasion, obviously. We need to be more thoughtful about our speech, though. As God's children, these should be our defining characteristics. We'll finish with Romans 8, 14 through 17. All who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God, for you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, heirs of what? Of heaven, provided we suffer with him in order that we may be glorified with him. This idea of being led by the Spirit of God, we need to act like him, be people of truth, people who speak the truth in love. That's one of the components of being led by his Spirit. But what truth does the Spirit witness? That we are his children. We know that he can't lie. We've read that several times. So when he bears the Spirit himself bearing witness to who? To the judge. And I think about this, most of all, I think about this in judgment, right? I think about this when we stand before him in the last day. Because a lot of this language has been about the courtroom, right? The courtroom analogy. That when we think about these things, it's in a context of justice and court and judging and making the right decision. When I stand in judgment before the Holy One who created all things, who made heaven and earth and everything that is in them, and I stand before him, there will be one saying, God, don't let this guy into heaven. This guy's a jerk. He did all these horrible things, and this was the kind of person that he was, and that will be the devil, the accuser, the adversary. Hopefully there will be one on the other side who is saying, God, let him in. He's been washed. He's been cleansed. He is your child. He is the one who belongs with you, and that will be the Spirit bearing witness on my behalf that I belong with God if I have been led by that Spirit, right? If I have done the things that God requires of me and lived as his child, then that's what I had to look forward to, is the Spirit bearing witness for me. And that would be great, because I don't just want the devil on one side and nobody speaks up for me. That would be disastrous, wouldn't it? Be sure that you have that advocate, the one who will intercede and bear witness on your behalf, the one who will help you in judgment stand before God with confidence and boldness, not afraid, because you know that you are of the truth. Be united with Christ